Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Happy Hanukkah and Merry Christmas to all of you, and welcome to a very special episode of iGen Politics.
We recorded this episode earlier this year, and we want to give it to you today because Senator Patrick Leahy, who is our guest today, gave his final farewell address to the Senate floor. And we asked him in this conversation about his book, his long and storied career in the Senate and public service. And so we hope you enjoy this episode during the holiday season. We'll be back next week with another episode of iGen Politics. But please enjoy this and have a happy, happy holidays.
Welcome back to iGen Politics. This is a podcast that makes politics engaging and relevant for all generations. This is Victor Xi.
And I'm Jill Wine Banks. And today's Jill's pin is an American flag because we are talking to an American legend. Today, our guest has served in the Senate longer than almost anyone else. He is certainly the current longest serving senator. Our guest is Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, and he's just written The Road Taken, a memoir. Victor and I enjoyed the book and want to talk to him about that and about his years in the Senate, his perspective on how politics have changed since he was first elected, and what changes need to be made to the Senate in order to make it better functioning. And although he has been in the Senate now for 48 years, which is many years before certainly Victor was born and most of our listeners. And it's about the same time as I joined the Watergate Special Prosecution Force. So this is going to be a great episode with lots of wisdom and some unique angles. And I want Victor to tell you a little bit more about his background.
So Senator Leahy was elected to the U.S. Senate in 1974 and reelected seven more times after that. Sadly, earlier this year, Senator Leahy announced that he will be retiring at the end of this term. Currently, he's a president pro tempore and chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. He has also served for 20 years as chair or ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, where he remains the most senior Democrat. He is also the most senior Democrat on the Senate Agriculture Committee, where he previously served as chair for 7 years.
Thank you, Senator Leahy, for being here with us today. It is great to have you here.
Well, I was looking forward to it, and I appreciate it. It's nice to be able to do something like this from home, unlike when I'm down in the Senate and have to wear a tie.
Well, yes, this is a casual conversation. So let's start. So you have this great new book out, and most elected officials write memoirs to benefit themselves politically. So I'm wondering, why did you write yours as you're leaving office?
Well, you know, I've kept a daily journal most days since I've been in the Senate. And after I decided I'm not going to run again, I'm going back through that journal, and friends of mine said, why don't you take parts out of it and write a book? Nobody can claim you're doing it for re-election. Just do it. So COVID slowed it up a little bit, which turned out to be actually somewhat of a benefit because I ended up being the only senator to preside over an impeachment trial. The second one of Donald Trump, the Chief Justice declined. He'd already done one. And as President Pro Tem, I was next in line. So I finished up my notes of that and put the book together. I call it The Road Taken. And it's partly to show where what the Senate was and could be, what the Senate is today, And I hope it'll be kind of a lesson to incoming senators as to what the Senate should be.
Absolutely. I think you do that so well. And we're going to get to some of those moments that you touch on, including the January 6th, you're presiding over the impeachment trial for that. But let's talk about your first taste in politics. You were 6 years old and you had just gone off riding a tricycle for then Governor Williams Wills, who was the governor of Vermont at the time. So tell us about that experience. Do you remember much about that tricycle?
Unfortunately, I remember too much of it. A friend of mine, one of my kids I played with all the time, we had gone over to the state house. I grew up almost across the street from it. He just walked in. There was no security or anything. We had our tricycles. We'd ride them down these marble halls. And we said, well, let's bring them upstairs. So we go up these stairs, and we race down the hall. There's an open door. We go right into it. I go wham into this desk. Now, at my age, I looked up at the desk. It was 25 feet high, or that's the way it appeared, until this head leans over and goes, yes. I said, hi, are you the governor? He said, yes, I am. Now get out. So, okay. But he did give us some candy on the way out. We thought it was a great adventure. I got home and I told my parents about it. They did not see the humor in that. And I was told no more tricycle riding in the state house. But it was an interesting experience. And even today, when I walk into the governor's office, it's ceremonial office now, he always goes, did you bring your tricycle? I said, no.
Well, that is a great story. You mentioned your parents. Did they have any influence on your early interest in politics? I understood that they worked in the press, but did they have any influence on your interest in politics growing up?
Well, the press they had was the Leahy Press. It was a printing business, and although they had owned a weekly newspaper in Waterbury. And they urged us to read. And my sister, Mary, my brother John, and I, we read all the time. And my father would have to leave school when he was an early teen because his father was also named Patrick J. Leahy. He had been a stone carver and died of silicosis of the lungs, which was not uncommon at that time. But he became a self-taught historian, my father did. And he was great in urging us to learn history. We'd walk around the state house with them all the time. They knew everybody. It was a heavily Republican state at the time. My parents were about the lone Democrats in Montpelier, but they knew everybody. And I loved the stories they told. And it just encouraged me to read more. I had my first library card when I was four. Wow. Our children's library, I just read everything I could. And I think that I found more and more an interest in what government did and all, as much as a child in this. Not, you know, from 4 years old to 12 years old might know.
Jill and I, we've talked a lot about libraries and just how important they are and how much they've had an influence on our lives. So that is a wonderful way to just be an informed citizen. And you write about your first real itch in politics, and that was seeing the presidential campaign of John F. Kennedy while you were a freshman at St. Michael's College in Vermont. There's so much that I read about in history books about that campaign, but I'd love to hear about, kind of from your perspective, what you thought was unique about that campaign and why you felt drawn to it.
Well, I felt, you know, here's the youngest person I'd seen as running for president. He just was inspiring, and I'd gone out campaigning for him. I'm wearing my jacket, St. Michael's College, my undergraduate school, which at that time was all male, predominantly Catholic, and I'd knock on doors and people would say, well, we don't like Nixon, but you can't really expect us to vote for a Catholic. And which was kind of a, I said, okay, not knowing that 10 years later, I was going to be running for the U.S. Senate. And, but I was so intrigued with Kennedy and watching the election debates and everything else. And then when I went to law school at Georgetown, I actually had a couple of different occasions to see President Kennedy in an open car going through down Pennsylvania Avenue with a visiting head of state as young interns doing things and students. He had a thing on the lawn of the White House and got to see him and see him up close and all. And it was just intriguing. And then the sad time was when Marcel and I, newlyweds, and we're standing on Pennsylvania Avenue watching the hearse go by with President Kennedy and struck by the absolute silence of hundreds of thousands of people lying there. It was so quiet. We're up near the Capitol. You could hear the drums as they were leaving the White House. And I remember President Kennedy's, the hearse going by, the horse, Blackjack, leading it, seeing one car with Robert Kennedy, not looking at anybody, just with his head in his hands. It was quite a moving thing.
You're going to make me cry because I was also in college at the time. And I remember exactly how moving and how tearful all that was. I also, it was part of the Young Democrats at the University of Illinois, and he actually came downstate to campaign, and I was one of the people who was selected to meet him. And
wow, you're lucky.
I know. He was a unique and compelling political figure. He was charismatic. He was young, handsome, had great ideas. And I think it did turn a lot of people into political junkies because he was just so wonderful. But
well,
anyway, I
got to, as a law student, I've been recruited. Robert Kennedy had invited, as Attorney General, invited in a half dozen students from six different law schools based on our academics standings, and was urging us to come to the Department of Justice. My wife and I were homesick. We wanted to get back to Vermont, so I declined. But when he ran for the presidency, I had volunteered. I was a young prosecutor, yeah, and I had volunteered for him. And I'll never forget the morning we'd seen him win in California. He'd gone to bed. I had a trial the next day. We had a special phone in the house. The state police could call me if they needed something in the middle of the night. Phone rang 3 o'clock in the morning. I recognized the dispatcher's voice, but she was very emotional. They said, they shot him. They shot him. Mm-hmm. And I said, shot who? It was not unusual call because there'd been a shooting or something like that. I said, Senator Kennedy, and I'm coming awake. And I said, which one? I said, Robert Kennedy. And we went down, turned on the news, and I sit at breakfast that next morning. That's it. I'm having nothing more to do with politics or anything else. That day, a letter arrived, been mailed a couple of days before from California. It was a note from Robert Kennedy thanking me for campaigning for him and asking, because I was official, actually, in the National District Attorney Association at that time, would I go and visit prosecutors' offices, prosecutor groups in other states and campaign for him. I still have the letter. I still have the letter.
That's
and I changed my mind about.
That's
politics.
Quite amazing. He was actually assassinated. I was awoken by a phone call from one of my law school classmates. It was the day of our graduation, and that was the message she had for me: was Robert Kennedy was just assassinated, and it certainly
was unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
It was, and I mean, we had Martin Luther King, his brother. I mean, it was really, it put a pall over graduation. I will certainly say that.
I know it did. I walked in Vermont. We had a home that. Down in the country, an old tree farm. I walked the fields. I walked the woods, and just thought about it. But because he was somebody who so inspired young people, they both did. And of course, at that time, I never thought I'd be serving in the U.S. Senate with his brother, Ted Kennedy.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of history in my book. The hardest part you were asking, how you do it, going back through thousands of pages of notes, some scribbled where I have a hard time reading my own writing, from my journals of what's going on each day, and what do you put in, what do you keep out, but. I enjoyed the memories, and I knew I was writing it because as we were finishing up, we had already decided, Marcel and I had, that I was not going to run again. So nobody could complain that the book The Road Taken was for a campaign thing, but might be something that new senators can look at and see the way it was and the good that it was, the Senate was, and unfortunately what's happened, especially since January 6th.
Yeah. Well, let's maybe jump forward to that part of your book about, and at one point in your book, you say, the Senate has some problems, but you're not writing a requiem for it. You are writing a reform of it, a way to make it better. And I think that's an important part of your book. And I'd like to hear more about that. What you think are the ways that we should maybe improve the Senate?
Well, I'm not naive enough to think the Senate was ever perfect. I mean, we had, for years, it enabled segregation and things like that. Until finally Lyndon Johnson and others forced changes in our civil rights laws. But the Senate was always better, or was better, when it tried to be the conscience of the nation. I used as an example in the book, you had two or three of the leaders of the Republican Party in the Senate, Hugh Scott, who was the Republican leader, Barry Goldwater, who was had run for president, was Mr. Conservative. And they went down in a time, and both told me they had no joy in doing this, but went down to the White House to tell Richard Nixon, you have to leave. I compare that today with people who know and knew that Donald Trump had committed crimes, had done things no president should, and yet they felt they had to go out and publicly defend him. What I'm asking is, go back to where the Senate was. It's a six-year term, and take advantage of it being a six-year term. Let it, the Senate should be, can be, the conscience of the nation. There's only 100 of us for 325 million Americans. Stop thinking about your own reelection or what you want, might want to run for. Think about the country.
You know, I remember when there was bipartisanship, and you actually, in your book, talk about the culture and spirit of the Senate, and when you were first elected and how it is now. Bipartisanship back when you were first elected was a real thing. Democrats and Republicans spent the weekends in Washington. They dined together. They talked to each other. They compromised. And you talk a lot about that, and you talk about the word conscience as something that politicians had when you first joined the Senate, and how that allowed members to transcend politics and allow that bipartisan solution finding. Members disagreed without being disagreeable. So talk to us more about that and how we could get back to a time where that exists again.
It would help if senators of both parties took the long view on things. Instead of what tweet can I have out that will be picked up online the next hour? Simplistic either left or right statement I can make that will be picked up for the moment. Think of the long run. I'll use some examples. When I became chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee, it had been led by Jesse Helms, who was very partisan, conservative, and treated it that way. I became chair, and I arranged to get one of our military planes and take the committee to several states, what we call CODEL, or congressional delegation. We'd go to a state represented by a Republican on the committee. We'd hold a hearing. I'd ask the Republican to chair the hearing, even though I was chair of the full committee. Then a Democratic state and vice versa. We spent so much time talking with each other, finding that conservative Republicans, liberal Democrats, everybody in between, we had a lot of things we agreed upon. And we came together and wrote some of the best farm bills. One example is I wrote a bill that gave the standards for organic farming. Everybody had said in the past that that's just a minor thing. It would never amount to anything. It's a $60 billion industry now in the country, but it's because Republicans and Democrats came together. I've used other examples in that, the Leahy War Victims Fund to get prosthetics that help for people who have been injured by landmines and whether our landmines or other people's landmines. I used that to get a bipartisan group to do some of the first overtures to Vietnam, something that John McCain and John Kerry had done. We did it in bringing funds for people who had been lost their limbs from predominantly American landmines. And again, I brought a bipartisan group of Republicans and Democrats there. And they all the time. It's a long flight. We sat around the conference room in the airplane. We talked about things. Again, we found so much that we agreed upon and it helped later on. That is the thing that I try in the book to point out times when we could come together and we've stopped doing that. We've got to go back doing it. We saw it here recently when we had a session that started on a Saturday afternoon, went until Sunday afternoon, and had dozens of votes that were 50-50. Well, we ought to be able to find more common ground than that.
So if I can follow up with that, I find that so fascinating. As just a young person living in this world, you see the Senate and there doesn't seem much to be happening. And, you know, reading your book, I was struck by just how much bipartisanship there was when you first arrived. And I'm wondering if you can break it down for some of the young listeners and just for our audience, what exactly caused that deterioration of bipartisanship?
Interestingly enough, I think it was influenced by what was happening in the House. When Newt Gingrich came in and he said everything had to be all or nothing and for the Republican Party. And a lot of his people who supported him on that then became senators and felt it should be the same way. Well, I point out that it's a six-year term. Work out your differences. Find things we agree upon. I've probably passed more bipartisan legislation than any other senator in the last 30 or 40 years. But it's been because we've done things together. And again, I use the congressional delegations to bring them. I use Vietnam as an example in getting the support of then the first President Bush, who supported me on that. And I recall coming back and telling him how I was asked to lift a legless man into a wheelchair. He lost his legs from an American landmine. And during the speeches people were giving, he was just staring at me, and I thought how he must hate me. And I picked him up. He probably weighed 65 pounds. I put him in the wheelchair. As I started to get up, he grabbed my shirt, and he pulled me down, and he kissed me. And I remember telling that to President Bush, and he was choked up hearing about it. And he said, you know, sometimes we do the right thing around here. Yeah. And it led to other visits, cleaning up of Agent Irons from Da Nang and so on. But it also helped improve where we're going with Vietnam.
Yeah.
I had voted against the war in Vietnam when I came to the Senate. I'm the first member of Congress from Vermont to vote to end the war in Vietnam. And the vote we had was in the Armed Services Committee. It was by a one vote margin. I was the newest member of the committee. I was proud of that vote, even though I was told by people in Vermont that it would cost me re-election. I said, well, what's the sense of being in the Senate if you're afraid to cast a vote you know is right? Mm-hmm.
And there are too many members who don't do that now. And I'm wondering, first, so you talk a lot about in your book how the Senate is a broken place and you give solutions about how it can be improved. I'm wondering, how much do you think that is because of Republicans? How much are Republicans are at fault for making the Senate what it is now?
Well, I think when you take a winner-take-all view, that's what happens. And again, since the Gingrich time, there's been more of a view on that, but I try to point out to people is when Republicans and Democrats work together, we get things done. I'll give you an example. I wanted to update the Violence Against Women Act. And I worked with Mike Crapo, a conservative Republican. And I know that he was concerned about the violence against Native American women in his state. He'd been to some of these shelters and seen and heard their stories. So we joined together on that. He was asked by some of the Republican leadership, why are you doing this? You know, Leahy might use this in a re-election. And he said, I'm interested in the women we're going to help. Now, I went over to the House, which had Republican control, and they said they couldn't take it up because it would violate the Hastert rule. They felt that was a sacred rule. You had to have a majority of the Republicans for it. Fortunately, a Republican House member, Tom Cole, Native American, supported it, and we got it passed. We also added the sexual trafficking of children. It was a major step forward. But I remember when Barack Obama, President Obama, called me at home to congratulate me on getting it passed, I said, call Mike Crapo, because if we hadn't had a bipartisan coalition and he kept his word all the way through, it wouldn't have passed. And it's just, I've had so many examples of that. Usually they don't get much publicity because they say, oh, it passed it. It was easy. They're not easy. It means you've got to spend time with each other. But when you have, when you come in late on Monday afternoon, and you have partisan meetings and you leave Thursday, everybody leaves town, you don't have the time of members getting together and knowing each other. We've got to go back to that.
Yeah. So, and one of the things that I'm curious about and that has gotten so much media attention is the filibuster. And you've seen the Senate for a long time and understand its rules better than anyone else. And wondering how much does something like the filibuster stand in the way of progress? And are there any other rules that you think do more harm than good?
Well, my first term here, then Fritz Mondale was a senator before I became vice president. We worked to change the filibuster rule and we lowered the threshold considerably. But it was rarely ever used, once or twice, possibly a year, and just forced everybody together to work out a compromise. Now when you use it 30, 40 times a year, it's lost any meaning. And whether you're in the minority or the majority, it helps nobody.
Do you think it can be eliminated?
I think it will be greatly diminished. I think when people realize that you use that just to slow things up instead of having real debate, I mean, we use it on dozens of nominations. They're going to pass anyway. Normally, those would be done a bunch of them together in one voice vote. But it's done to slow up things so you don't have real legislation. I'd rather have real legislation, sit there and debate it, bring up amendments, vote on them, and we'd be a lot better off. The country would be a lot better off. We've done this on some things. Aid to Ukraine, for example. We came together on that. For some reason, Republicans thought they should vote to block help for victims of the burn pits, our military who came back and had cancer and all these other things from it, and they blocked it the first time around. And there'd been such an outpouring from the American public across the political spectrum saying, we owe a duty to these people that suffered in Iraq or Afghanistan. And they brought it back up and they got a strong bipartisan support to pass it. And I was very proud as three people have to sign the legislation when it's passed: the Speaker, the President pro tem, and the President of the United States. It was the first day I was out of the hospital from my hip injury, and I was so proud to go to Capitol Hill and sign that bill. But it was a bipartisan bill, and that's how it got through.
Yeah, that's the way we used to work, and hopefully someday can again.
I hope so.
One last question about my new favorite cause, which is the Equal Rights Amendment. It's still pending. There's some proposals now before Congress to make the president tell the archives to publish it, which would make it the 28th Amendment, because 38 states have ratified it, and that's all it takes to amend the Constitution. How are you feeling about the chances of it becoming the 28th Amendment?
I wish it could be. You know, I voted for it before. Yeah. I've supported it. Of course, we supported it in Vermont. I think after the recent Supreme Court decisions, and after some of the threats made by Justice Thomas, I think we have to do it. Whether it will happen or not, I don't know, but I would strongly support that.
Well, before you leave the Senate, please tell your friend, President Biden, that it is within his power. I've done some significant research on this, and I am convinced that you cannot withdraw a ratification, so the states that are trying to withdraw their vote cannot, and that the timeline that was set for ratification is not binding, and that 38 states have voted, and that's it. So please,
we'd have to have a pretty clear understanding,
yeah,
that is the law. And I must admit, I have not researched that. My position on ERA has been very clear.
Yeah.
Vermont's position has been very clear.
Yeah.
We ratified it. The procedure you've just discussed is something I'd want to research.
Yeah.
And if that's the way it can be done, of course it should be.
So during your book, you talk a lot about your time on the Judiciary Committee, and I watched your questioning of Ketanji Brown Jackson when she was answering questions in front of the Judiciary Committee. And there was this one moment where you were quite visibly frustrated with people like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, or I guess people who were sat on the committee and who really made a mockery of that institution. And I'm wondering, you know, I guess, do you ever try to talk to your fellow Republican senators about their conduct? And if so, how do they respond?
I do try to talk to them about it. These things are outrageous. I know they're both running for president. They want the soundbite. Do soundbites and something else. They were talking about lifetime appointments, and one of them said to me, "Well, you know, Democrats, you're never going to vote for Republican appointees." I said, "Really?" I said, "I voted for more Republican nominees to the Supreme Court, the Courts of Appeals, and the District Court than you have. So don't talk that way." But then you automatically vote against Democrat nominees. And I think it was it Ted Cruz when he talked about her nomination, and he said, what does this say to a qualified white man? And the misogynist, racist comment like that, my response was, walk down the halls of the Supreme Court, count the number of white men, portraits from the time the first Supreme Court on the wall. Tell me, how many black women do you see? And, I have a grandchild who is biracial. She was so happy to see the nomination of the justice to be. And I told her that when we met. And so on the way out, and she had seen her picture in my office. On the way out, she said, is there anything I can do for her? I said, Judge, you already have.
Oh.
Just the example you set.
That is so lovely.
And, you know, I met her family. The irony is just the opposite of our family. Her husband is white. Her children have the same mixture. A couple of our grandchildren, her son-in-law is African-American, daughter is white. And it reflects our country. And she will be a superb justice. She'll take office as justice first of October, and she will bring a position to the Supreme Court that maybe we start making the Supreme Court look more like America. It's certainly not acting that way, as they saw in the latest decision overturning Roe. There's not an awful lot of support in the country for that. And again, it's a change in times. I remember when Brown versus Board of Education, which did away with segregation, overturned Plessy versus Ferguson. But the Supreme Court worked for 2.5 years on that to have a unanimous decision, because it was going to be unpopular in parts of the country. And they wanted then President Eisenhower to be able to enforce it, to say it's a unanimous court. And now the Supreme Court is becoming more and more politicized, and that hurts the country. When the U.S. Senate becomes politicized, it hurts the country. I have nothing against having Republicans bringing up amendments. Let's vote on them. They win, then that becomes a law. But don't make it automatic litmus test kind of legislation. That hurts the country.
So I want to end, before we run out of time, by talking about something in your epilogue. You said the advice that you wish you had had for your 34-year-old self as you look back now as an 80-year-old is this, and I'm going to read it. Don't lose that sense of awe, kid. Hold on to it. Treasure it. Don't even for a minute forget what a privilege and a responsibility it is to serve here. And so I just wonder whether there's anything, because I think that sort of says it all, but is there anything you would like to add to that for Victor and his generation, who are the up-and-coming leaders of our country?
I would tell them, you're one of 100 representing 325 million Americans. Think of that. Don't put yourself first. Put the country first. And there's very good in Republicans and Democrats. Come together for the sake of the country. If you don't, if you let the Senate just become a polarized, partisan place, it hurts the country. It hurts everybody in the country, the 34-year-olds and the 80-year-olds. And I must tell you, when I walked down the halls of the Capitol, I still feel that sense of awe.
Yeah.
And when I walk out of there on January 3rd, I will carry with it that sense of awe and a realization that I was greatly privileged to serve there. In my book, I call it The Road Taken. Of course, that's from the Robert Frost poem, Two Roads in the Wood Diverge.
Yeah.
And I took the one less traveled by, and that made all the difference. I'm glad I took the road I did.
And so are we. So is all of America. We thank you for your service to this country and for spending time with us today talking about your book and your Senate years. And we wish you the very best in whatever is next for you.
Well, thank you. And thank you for some of the memories we've shared together here today.
Thank you so much, Senator Leahy.
Take care.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of iGen Politics with Senator Leahy. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did, and that you'll tune in next week for another great episode of iGen Politics. In the meantime, be sure to subscribe to us on YouTube or wherever you follow your podcasts, and be sure to also leave us a 5-star review and rating, as that helps others find this podcast and helps us tremendously. Thanks so much again for tuning in, and we'll see you next week for another episode of iGen Politics.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.